Know the Source on One Radio Network.
This is OneRadioNetwork.com, March 19, 2019. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. We're going to put on our tinfoil hat tomorrow and talk to Richard Grove. Pretty curious, very interesting fellow. We'll talk about big picture, the people that kind of run the world. I think you'll find it fun. He's a big fan of Carol Quigley's work, Tragedy and Hope, which was one of Andrew Goss's favorite books. And so we'll have fun tomorrow. Talk about that. And I think we're going to do a little financial thing on Thursday. Yeah, that'll be different. And also Dr. Gabriel Cousins on Thursday. He's written quite a paper on 5G and a lot of research, and so we're going to dig more into that one. And some really weird things going on geopolitically and politically with this whole 5G thing too, as well with China. You know, it's kind of like, the more you look at it, and I don't really dig into it very, very deeply, but it's more like a John Grisham novel, you know, to keep track of all this stuff. But definitely something spooky on big level stuff going in with the 5G technology. Who wants to control it? And they get a feeling they know exactly what's going on. Dr. Ray Peet has been kind enough to come on the show from time to time the last few months. And he has a PhD in biology, University of Oregon, specialization in physiology. And he's taught at different University of Oregon, Urbana College, Montana State University, National College of Naturopathic Medicine, Universidad Veracruzana. And he started his work early on with progesterone and related hormones in 68, in papers in physiological chemistry and physics, 671 and 72. And his website, raypeet.com, and you can sign up for his newsletter, and he'll tell you more about that. Just a plethora of articles on his website, and we already have some emails of folks want to ask him some questions and see how he's doing. Let's see if we can get to the right control here, and we'll make this work. Good morning, Dr. Peet.
Good morning. Just as I came on, I heard you talking, I think, about genetic modified food.
Yes, sir.
I didn't hear everything you were talking about, just the tail end of it, but that is something everyone, I think, should be very concerned about. Did he talk about the research of Seralini and Suroff and Baranova?
I haven't heard those names, but yeah, talk about that.
For example, Baranova and Suroff fed different combinations of modified grains to hamsters, and found that each generation the symptoms were worse, until in the third generation they were sterile. And that's something that biologists have been covering up for at least 50 years, probably much longer, that when something mildly harmful persists beyond one generation, it is intensified every generation, even without modifying or mutating genes. It accumulates epigenetic changes, changes the course of development of the species. And in just three generations of eating whatever had gone wrong with that grain. The animals were sterile in the third generation.
Wow. So they gave animals a GMO grain, and then third generation, they're sterile.
Most of them are very, very small litters, and the few that survived were sterile. And that had been done 50 or 60 years ago. I read experiments in which they would make a small nick in the egg of a frog or other animal with large eggs, and there would be slight changes as that animal grew up, but its offspring would be even more damaged, and then the third generation wouldn't be able to reproduce at all.
And you're saying, what mechanism does that work through, epigenetically?
The mechanists say that if it doesn't change your genes, it doesn't hurt you at all, because they say that everything is permanently built into the genes as we develop. You simply print out what is inherited, but that simply isn't the way life works. That was a big dogma starting in 1890 and gaining steam early in the 20th century, called neo-Darwinism. But it became a whole doctrine in medicine, for example, until just about 1975 or 80, doctors were, almost all of them were insisting that a woman could be starved or stressed, very sick, as long as the baby could stay in the uterus. It wasn't going to be affected at all by anything that happened to the health of the mother. But in fact, animal experiments have been showing that anything you do, if your grandmother was stressed or poorly nourished, your health is going to be, it shows up in human studies, but it was clearly demonstrated in animal studies that the whole body changed its form. The brain was smaller, high blood pressure was higher, everything was a little damaged for generations after a serious stress.
And that was based on the idea of a permanent kind of a gene that doesn't change?
It applies, for example, carbon groups, methyl groups, are attached to the ordinary DNA chains so that they react differently with the rest of the organism. The organism can't see them when they're covered up with this methyl group.
And so then we know then with ongoing dietary and lifestyle things, and but then these genes do express themselves differently.
Everything is constantly being checked against what's going on elsewhere in the organism and its environment. And so we're constantly being changed. Our genes are constantly being expressed according to the present situation. So the whole doctrine of immutable genes, except when they're mutated, that was a fantasy that was imposed for political reasons.
So this could be used for a positive idea.
It has the opposite implications. When the 1960 group in Berkeley started experimenting with giving very interesting situations to their lab animals, playgrounds instead of little boxes to live in. And the offspring learned better. The parents grew up happier, slightly bigger, and more intelligent, but the offspring were still more intelligent. The third generation had bigger brains than had ever been measured before. and similar things in chickens. They didn't have playgrounds to entertain them and develop their brains, but they found that adding an amino acid or glucose to the egg, punching a hole in it and just putting some sugar in the egg when the chicken's brain normally had reached its peak development, the brain went on developing if it was simply provided more glucose. And the chickens were born more intelligent than chickens had ever been with bigger brains.
So to mom and dads listening, the better, the more things we can do in utero and afterwards for the kids, they can actually get stronger.
Yeah, to keep the blood supply and all the nutrients and oxygen and sugar going to the developing baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What anything in particular that you have been top of mind for you in the last, since we talked about a month ago? Anything pop up?
For years I've been noticing that drugs and nutritional supplements and foods and cosmetics are being modified for the manufacturer's ease with silicon dioxide powder.
Yeah.
And I've finally decided to bring together some concrete information about that. And everything you look at from genetically modified food to the things they put in our food, everything is having that kind of an epigenetic effect, changing us every time we eat it, but staying in the tissues. People, when they reproduce, are having modified reproductive cells that are effective starting out earlier and earlier each generation.
So you mentioned silicon dioxide. It's in a lot of stuff. Is this something we do definitely want to keep out of our bodies?
I don't buy any supplement that contains
silicon
particulate matter such as titanium dioxide or silica.
Yeah.
Silicon dioxide.
Yeah. It's curious. Most of the sulfur that's out there that's sold, the pure MSM, they all have this silicon dioxide. The one that we promote does not. I wonder why they use it.
I've talked to a few of the people that produce the products with it, mm-hmm. and they've simply been sold on the idea that it makes the product easier to manufacture and package. It's a lubricant. people fairly often ask me, how safe is Teflon? And even though if you're careful with Teflon, it's no big problem, but everyone in the country has some of the monomer precursors that are used in making Teflon in their tissues. The stuff is contaminating everyone to some extent, but this stuff, it isn't an ingredient of food, but it can be used as a lubricant. It's very slippery when you use the monomer precursor that they make Teflon out of. And this lubricant can be used on the machinery that is used for packaging food or manufacturing things. And one of the products is called food-grade lubricant, and it contains silica and the monomers of Teflon, the perfluoroethylene, for example.
So they're using it. I think Dr. Bob Marshall talked about it years ago. They were using it to facilitate getting the into capsules and stuff like that into the machines.
And they don't have to mention it in the ingredients when it's used as a processing aid, the FDA calls it. So we don't even see on the label things that are actually industrially being added.
Yeah. What is the silicon dioxide, Dr. Pete, do in the body? What's it do?
The size of the particle determines the effect. People for 100 years have been saying that it's the natural crystalline fiber of asbestos that made it carcinogenic. But more detailed studies show that amorphous silica is also inflammatory and eventually fibrogenic and carcinogenic, and that it depends on the size of the particle. The thing about the asbestos fiber is that it's linear and has a high ratio of length to diameter. But if you have a particle which, according to the particular area of the cell, a group of proteins called the inflammasome, to this particle, to this little organelle, a particle of a certain size is interpreted the same as the end of a splinter of an asbestos crystal.
Mm-hmm.
So that the size range, as it gets smaller towards a nanoparticle rather than a microparticle, it becomes more toxic, and it also enters the cells more easily. They've been warning about inhaled particles from smoke and dust and various industrial contaminants. Just the grinding of tires on concrete highways, for example, throws up a very fine dust that is inhaled and is one of the major toxins around city air, a combination of smoke and dust. And this is recognized as when the particles are below a certain diameter, roughly the size of a bacteria and smaller, that they're able to pass through the lungs into the bloodstream, affect the heart and brain and every organ in the body. But even though that has been recognized for a long time as something that is very dangerous, entering the lungs, people put this junk in our foods and we swallow it, and the same thing happens. It passes through the wall of the intestine. Cells in the intestine specifically are designed to take up and sample antigens in the food. And these particular cells will deliberately take up cells as part of our defensive reaction, but they take up the particles of, for example, silica, and then they can't digest it. They accumulate it, and their immune macrophage-like function is gradually destroyed by accumulating this indigestible fibrous material.
Interesting. Dr. Ray Pete is with us, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. What are some of the other common adjuvants, or not adjuvants, but tag-alongs that we see in supplements very popular that we want to stay away from? Any top of that for you?
I think anything other than sugar or salt or other relatively pure edible substance shouldn't be there at all.
Really? Sugar, salt, just anything else, just don't mess with it.
For example, stearic acid.
Yeah, that's the one I wanted to ask about. Yes, stearic.
Magnesium stearate, it sounds chemically like it's a perfectly edible substance, but it's a manufactured substance. It passes through the machines, and they don't say what has been on the machines before in making that additive. Mm-hmm. Way down the line, it's accumulating small amounts of allergens and such.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Pete, is there anything that you do pretty regularly in your life after all your years of studying these things, where you'll pop up different isolated nutrients just to kind of hedge your bets?
Let me see. I have stopped using any nutritional supplement orally just because of having seen how they're made and knowing. First, I started having experiences. I could eat. I could consume gallons, literally, of orange juice, huge amounts of vitamin C coming in, or guavas or other fruit, very rich in vitamin C. Mm-hmm. But I found that the smallest amount of a vitamin C supplement gave me first a very bad cough and then intestinal inflammation and headaches. And after I identified that, I started mentioning it to other people, and dozens of other people overcame their chronic phlegminess, cough, runny nose, constipation, headaches, and so on, just by giving up their supplements. Yeah. And I found that I would occasionally eat a piece of bread or breakfast cereal or salami or something and have a bad reaction. I would look on the label and see that they had added ascorbic acid to it. So it would take only about 2 milligrams of a synthetic ascorbic acid to make me very sick, even if I didn't know I was ingesting it until I looked at the label, where I could consume 4,000 milligrams of ascorbic acid in the natural form occurring in food.
So you don't feel it's necessary to do a supplemental vitamin C ascorbic acid or sodium ascorbate or something in general for our listeners? Not necessary?
No. After I stopped taking it, I wondered if I was going to develop a deficiency, but I just kept eating regular foods, milk, eggs, meat were my basic foods, very few vegetables. And after a couple months of that in the lab, I decided to check how much ascorbic acid was coming out in my urine 2 months later. And I found I was putting out between 1 and 2,000 milligrams in my urine every day. Huge amounts couldn't have been stored for that long. So what was happening was I was extracting vitamin C from meat and milk, even. And the nutrition charts usually show meat as having very little ascorbic acid, which technically it does, but that is a clue to what ascorbic acid is doing in our tissues. It isn't very, very little of it is present in the form of ascorbic acid, but the same molecule in the oxidized form is roughly eight times more concentrated in the cells than outside the cells. And in the cells, ascorbic acid is an oxidant, an essential oxidant, for example, for forming the properly folded folded proteins that the cell is manufacturing. So the whole misinterpretation of where we're getting our vitamin C was confused, because it's really turning into dehydroascorbate in the body anyway, and that's what we're getting in things like meat, eggs, and milk.
Curious. Here's an email for you. I enjoyed your recent shows with Dr. Pete. I hope he keeps coming back on. I started eating chicken necks, carrot salads, and oranges to help my thyroid, and I'm feeling warmer, a little bit more energy. Could you please ask him the following? How does canned milk compare to fresh milk in terms of nutritional value? And is goat milk and goat cheese good sources of calcium and protein? I don't tolerate cow's milk very well.
The cheeses are great sources of most nutrients. They're like milk. They're deficient in iron, but they're extremely good for calcium, magnesium, B vitamins, vitamin C, and so on. And canned milk has always been recognized to be a little lower in vitamin C and slightly lower in some of the B vitamins. But the main concern historically was that the soldering of the cans involved lead. And I think finally, 20 or 30 years ago, that was corrected. But it's good to be alert to how the cans are made. Cans sometimes aren't properly lined, and the metal will oxidize the food, or there will be contaminants from putting a liner. For example, an estrogenic plastic has been used sometimes as liners.
Do some people do better on a goat or sheep's cheese or rather than cows for some reason?
The fat particle is more thoroughly homogenized in goat milk, and that gives you a fairly standardized ratio of fat to the other nutrients. And the goats are pickier about what they eat, so it is a more certain source of some nutrients, such as vitamin E, because they don't like to eat stale food.
But I guess with goats, you really got to be careful because they eat a lot of stuff, don't they?
Don't want them grazing around a junkyard.
Yeah, no telling. Get these glyphosate things.
But generally, goats live on fresh leaves.
Grace writes in, Dr. Pete recommends thyroid supplementation for anyone over 30. Theoretically, would this be on a daily basis, continually, and how much, till death do us part? Would this be the same for male or female?
I started thinking about that issue when I first went to school in Mexico and ate some unfamiliar food, like blood tacos and chicken neck soup and lots of crustaceans and even insects and such, and shellfish. And I realized that in 1940, the Agriculture Department in the U.S. declared that thyroid must be removed at the slaughterhouse and either sent to make fertilizer or animal food. I realized that everyone in the world who ate animal products, whether insects and crustaceans or mollusks or fish heads and animal waste organs and such, everyone was getting thyroid in their diet every day, just as part of the diet. And suddenly, 1940 or 42, all of our meat supply in the U.S. Was being deprived of the thyroid gland, which had previously been in all of the animal products. Milk became one of the rare sources of thyroid hormone. The mother is always putting her hormones into the milk, so progesterone and thyroid are slightly provided. For example, after Three Mile Island, the women who were breathing the isotopes leaking out of the nuclear reactor, there were no thyroid-deficient babies identified where they expected the radiation to have damaged some of the babies' thyroids. But while they were being breastfed, there were no thyroid-deficient babies because the milk was providing it. When they stopped nursing them, or if they hadn't been nursed at all, those were the ones who developed thyroid disease. So milk, for a baby at least, is a very important source of the hormones.
Leroy says, I've heard Mr. Pete on your show talk about the benefits of some fish and even shellfish. Is there not a concern with mercury with consuming fish?
Yeah, except that all of the food is now getting mercury in it. Smoke circulates around the world carrying a lot of mercury right over the continent. And studies of the mercury content of kids have found that the brightest ones had the highest mercury content, showing that if they're well nourished, the mercury can pass through them. Hans Selye did experiments poisoning animals with so much mercury that their kidneys were very, very seriously damaged. They had big white spots on them as the cells were dying. But then he gave them a good dose of vitamin C combined with the same amount of mercury and showed that their kidneys looked perfectly normal. And he showed that the mercury was being reduced to a non-toxic form that was able to pass through the body without sticking to the brain and so on.
Just with the proper nutrients.
A good balance of oxidizing and reducing substances.
Be darned. So the body just knows how to get rid of it.
The mostly unidentified molecules such as flavonoids in fruits and vegetables and some in the animals that have eaten them in the milk and so on, these flavonoids are very important for tuning up the right oxidative balance of cells, like vitamin C functioning as an oxidant in cells to keep the process of oxygen energy metabolism running.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Glenda, I've been doing this research on grains and wondering if I soak my grains, organic, of course, for 24 hours, it's similar to using some of the process with lye Mr. Pete talks about?
Oh, no, not exactly, but it is another way of creating a more nutritious product. If the grain hasn't been killed by heating or chemical treatment, then when you wet it, it activates the sprouting chemistry, even if it's been ground. So the enzymes that would grow a sprout are activated in the first roughly 12 to 24 hours, depending on temperature.
Mm-hmm.
When a seed is produced, it has to store enough material to make the proteins to grow a sprout before it can start producing its own energy. And that means that it has to store either starch or oil as an energy source, and some kind of concentrated nitrogen source, because it's going to have to make quite a lot of protein to grow the sprout. And that nitrogen is stored in certain amino acids that have more nitrogen than essential. Lots of arginine, for example, and lysine, nitrogen-rich amino acids, are packed into the seed. When you activate those enzymes, you are actually reducing the toxic proteins and starches and increasing the nutritional protein value. When it reaches a sprout state, it's more than twice as rich in protein as when it was in the seed stage. But sprouting moves it slightly in that direction, less toxic, and more nutritious. And the alkali process doesn't activate the proteins, but it chemically reduces some of the toxins and increases the amount of niacin in the cell.
And you would do that, you'd have to cook it, I guess. What do they cook it for an hour with a little lye, and then they let it soak for about, what, 10 hours or so?
Oh, I don't think they usually do it that long. They can send it to the mill the next morning if they cook it. I guess it's commonly left to soak for overnight.
But we could do that at home, too, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we would just cook it for an hour and then let it soak for a while?
You cook it until it swells up and the husk comes off the seed.
Okay. Let's get a phone call here. Good morning. Who's this? You're on the air with Ray P.
Hi, Patrick. This is Mike in Chattanooga.
Hello, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
A couple questions for Dr. Ray P, okay?
Okay.
First one is, I'm taking Armour Thyroid, and I'm taking 10 a day, and I don't feel any kind of pulse change or heating or anything. And my lab report says I'm going to, when they check my 3T3 and everything, all my lab work for thyroid back within the range. But yet, I'm taking Armour Thyroid, that many, and yet no change.
How much are you taking?
10 a day of the Armour Thyroid, 30 milligrams, and then I go and I'll take granulars to equal the same amount,
Well, that's a lot.
Broda Barnes, who was one of the pioneers in thyroid therapy, he did a PhD in physiology as well as his MD degree, and he actually did research through Eastern Europe on hypothyroidism and its consequences. And he found that the low thyroid regions had both high rates of cancer, especially breast cancer, and heart disease. And so he, starting in the 1930s through the 40s and 50s, put all of his hypothyroid patients on a thyroid supplement, and in his whole career of 30 years had no patient die of heart disease, where the average doctor in that many years would have had many patients who died of heart attacks and such. And his average dose was 120 milligrams of Armour Thyroid.
Okay, so these are actually, I think, 33 milligrams, but they are. So three of them, 99. Wonder if the American version that I'm getting, there's something weak in it, and it's not activating my thyroid, is what I'm saying, Dr. Pete. It's like, when you take 10, for some people, they can take one of them, and boy, it really helps them. But with me, no movement whatsoever. I was thinking there's something in my body that's just not letting my thyroid activate. And I eat a real clean diet, no grains, no junk and everything. I watch everything.
Broda Barnes found several things that were interfering with thyroid. He would give a person 30 milligrams for maybe a couple of months and watch their temperature as well as their symptoms. If they didn't feel a response, then he would increase it 30 milligrams at a time, watching their temperature. When the temperature came up to normal, so that when they woke up, it would be around 98 degrees, and then after breakfast, it would rise to about 98.5 or 6, he found that the symptoms would disappear when their temperature got up to the normal cyclic range. He found that several things would interfere with that. stresses of different kinds. He experimented on himself and found that too much protein, for example, eating too much muscle meat, would suppress the thyroid. And it's the cysteine and tryptophan, mostly in the muscle meat, methionine, cysteine, and tryptophan, which inhibit the thyroid. So you want to check the quality of the protein. Milk, the calcium content of milk protects against that anti-thyroid effect of methionine and cysteine.
Mike, are you certain that you're clear of any kind of root canals or cavitations?
Yeah, I've never had.
Have you had them checked out?
My dental is I don't have any root canals or no problems there.
But I mean, have you had it checked out with a good X-ray?
Well, yes, I keep up with all that. So my teeth are in real good shape. Or now, nothing showing up on X-ray. Okay? There could be something mild that are going on that I'm not aware of. Okay, but.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, if you can find a biological dentist and do a cone beam, and there could be issues 20, 30 years ago when you had your tooth pulled that you have a cavitation and you've never seen it without a proper X-ray, and you get these guys on one of the meridians, and they can affect things like thyroid that it'll never get right. I mean, it's worth exploring.
Yes, sir. Underlying infection that puts the stress on the body, like Dr. Pete's saying.
What's that?
Stress in different levels like that will cause these problems.
Sure.
Yeah. Have you checked your pulse rate? Does it increase at all?
I check it all the time, and it tries to stay around 58 to 60. And sometimes it will jump up. I've had it jump up to 84 at rest. And if I go walking, it doesn't go up. My pulse kind of stays, around the 70 or 80 or even 60 when I'm walking.
People have stored enough of the polyunsaturated fats in their tissues that it can take 6 months or more of the average dose of thyroid before their tissue starts responding. One woman I knew for 20 years took a normal amount of thyroid and still didn't lose either her symptoms or her excess fat. But when she got doctors to prescribe at the final dose, she was taking 15 grains of Armour for a while, and suddenly she recovered and went down to a normal dose to maintain. But sometimes it takes a temporary large dose to get the system going.
Sure. Stay right there, Dr. Pete Patrick. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Hope that's helpful. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com with Dr. Ray Pete. We'll continue. We have lots of emails for him this morning. A lot of folks, they say, well, yeah, I don't really have any problems in my mouth, no root canals and no cavitations. But then if you really talk to them, they've never really had them tested properly. It's really important. And as I said, you could get we all have our different wisdom teeth pulled out 20, 30, 40 years ago. And if you've never really looked at these guys with what they call a cone beam, and they're very, very incredibly accurate, Dr. Nunley has found these cavitations, which are small holes in the jaw that are just as bad as root canals with these anaerobic material that may be 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, and you just don't know they're there. So, I mean, it's just another piece to the puzzle. If you find somebody, a good biological dentist with a cone beam baby, It's not a great deal of a x-ray. It's not going to hurt you. It certainly would be better to figure out if you had something. You know, you could have some kind of chronic thing with thyroid or stomach or colon or who knows for years and never been able to get to the, you know, to the root cause of it. And if you've got one of these infections on one of these meridians in your body, you'd be hard-pressed to ever ditch it. I mean, it's just curious. And, you know, back in the day, and even today, most of the dentists, they don't know how to deal with taking out the ligament, really cleaning out these areas when they pull a tooth and doing little platelets and really making sure that it clumps up there and you get a good blood clot so there's no cavitation. It's a very silent, deep issue in our culture that very few people know about. And we have a whole section on our website on dental. So you should learn about these things. And it could be a piece of the puzzle that you haven't, you know, come across as yet.
Previously, we talked with Brandon Amalani about his Blue Shield product to protect against EMFs in your home.
The more connected we are, the more electromagnetic radiation we're going to have. So years ago, I'd play with Q-Links and just anything I can get my hands on that, whether I felt it working or not, I just wanted some kind of leverage against electromagnetic radiation and those frequencies and how they affect the cellular biology. But then when I met Mark and started really getting deep to his technology and really looking at the microprocessing technology, I've never found any EMF company that would not only to test on not only human blood and urine analysis, but also on animals, which totally weeds out the idea of placebo effect. I mean, the fact that you can plug these devices into a chicken farm, a factory farm, for about 15,000 laying hens, and all of a sudden the mortality rate, which is averages from 60 to 150 deaths per month, goes down to zero. I mean, it's pretty profound that a little device, a little energy device, could actually like create such a harmony and balance within the environment to where claustrophobic chickens that are crammed in together actually get along better and actually feel better. And the you know, the biological markers are improved over that 1 year study.
There's quite a bit of science with this Blue Shield product. You can see the ad on the front page. Promo code ONERADIO will get you a 10% discount. This works on the cells in the body. Very cool technology. Front page, Blue Shield, OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously with cardiologist Dr. Joel Kahn, 35 years experience in cardiology.
On your commercial break, you hit a hot button because I'm a giant fan of infrared sauna and the cardiac benefits.
Tell us about why you like these saunas for the heart. What does it do?
In Japan, it's a traditional therapy of heart disease to even sick heart patients to sit for 15 or 20 minutes in an infrared sauna, then lie down and rest and hydrate for about half an hour. They call it Waon, W-A-O-N. It means soothing heat. And they've done research studies, like 30 of them, in humans. Anti-ages your arteries and improves the strength of your heart, and it may actually prolong survival in sick heart patients. Anybody can just, again, go to the internet, read about infrared sauna heart disease, or put my name there because I've written many articles about it. Now there's data coming out of Sweden and Finland because they've published some amazing data. The number of times a week you're in a sauna, number of minutes each time, you can just track out how long you're going to live. So very powerful therapy by being in, my favorite is an infrared sauna.
Well, I don't know about you, but if the heart muscles and the arteries are happy, things are good. Very important. We promote the Relax Far Infrared Sauna. Special price, not in print, $9.95, delivered continental U.S. Get your heart and keep your heart and arteries in fine shape by using the Relax Far Infrared Sauna. Email me for the special prize, patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
Okay, March 19th. Having a good time talking with Dr. Ray Pete. Dr. Pete, thanks for being here again. We really enjoy talking to you. What are some good things, speaking about the heart, that our listeners can do for these actual heart muscles? You know, the atherosclerosis is one thing, but the actual heart muscle and a lot of the heart incidences are really, I understand, myocardial infarctions, right, where the heart muscles give up or get sick or infected. What are some good and bad things we can do for the heart muscle itself?
Inflammation is the worst thing for the heart and the arteries. The hardening of the arteries starts with inflammation, and the polyunsaturated fats are the key to the inflammatory process. The prostaglandins amplify any little problem, lack of oxygen, overstress, irritants such as inhaled microparticles that get into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. Whatever starts the inflammation, then the polyunsaturated fat conversion to prostaglandins amplifies that and leads to the trapping of a combination of fatty acid and cholesterol. It isn't the pure cholesterol that causes the problem. It's the accumulated fatty acid ester of the cholesterol that causes problems in the brain and heart. And in animal experiments, a thyroid supplement can, for example, they would produce an enlarged fibrous heart in animals by constricting an artery. And when they had a large fibrotic heart, they found that a T3 supplement of active thyroid hormone would energize the heart so that it could clear out and reverse that excess collagen accumulation.
Interesting.
Brett Barnes found that all of the heart diseases were essentially prevented when he kept them on the right amount of thyroid for their whole life.
The T3 or the combo, doc?
He always used only the Armour thyroid. T3 hadn't been identified when he started his career, and then the industry synthesizing thyroxin convinced all the doctors in the country that Armour thyroid was unscientific because it contained this mixture of substances. The industry wanted to sell a pure substance, and so they used various marketing tricks to convince doctors that thyroxin was the same, but it wasn't. It definitely works in healthy young men the same way that natural thyroid works, but in a person under stress, aging, or simply having female hormones, the T3 isn't produced from thyroxin at an adequate rate. And so the Armour thyroid provided some of the T3 that everyone needs during stress. And when you've accumulated the polyunsaturated fats and produced the prostaglandins, then you don't activate your own tissues. The fats interfere with the use of glucose to activate thyroxin and turn it into T3. So as we accumulate the esters of cholesterol and polyunsaturated fats in our tissue and other fat stores, these progressively block the effects of the thyroid hormone, not only directly blocking the formation of the hormone, but all of the effects that the hormone should be having are blocked when you progressively accumulate these unsaturated fats.
Oh, poofus. Can Mr. Pete offer some recommendations on how to remove lipofuscin accumulation, a.k.a. age spots, from the surface of the skin on the face?
I saw people when I first started experimenting with progesterone. I saw a woman who had just gone on an estrogen supplement. She hadn't looked bad at the age of 45, but after 6 months taking an estrogen supplement, she had brown age spots all over her arms and face. And within just 2 or 3 weeks of using progesterone, those had disappeared. It was apparently some very great sensitivity to an estrogen excess that was balanced by the progesterone. But in the brain, it's been demonstrated that our cells can remove the spots of lipofuscin. And one experiment was demonstrating that vitamin E can activate the removal, but in that experiment, they were dissolving the vitamin E in ethanol, and they found that the very small amount of ethanol traveling along with the vitamin E was improving the action of the vitamin E. The ethanol at that tiny concentration was acting as an antioxidant, activating the body's ability to remove the lipofuscin.
Vitamin E with a little bit of ethanol.
Well, vitamin E is the best to use because when you eat it, that was an in vitro experiment, and if you eat the vitamin E, it gets into your bloodstream in the proper form that is optimal for stopping and reversing the age pigment.
And you can put them on externally as well, vitamin E?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. One was using food grade clay for detox or charcoal, how much would we know how much to use, writes Amy?
The 1970s, I ran across a German researcher, Gerhard Volkheimer, an immunologist, who had his medical students eat. He used starch particles of different diameters, from 10 times as big as a red blood cell down to microscopic particles just big enough to see under a high-powered microscope. And he would have them drink a slurry of this starch, and then every 15 minutes he would check their blood, their urine, and a few times the other body fluids, even cerebrospinal fluid, and found that every 15 to 30 minutes these particles would show up in a more remote part of the body, very quickly into the bloodstream. Later, he in animals, checked other particles, including charcoal, clay, various minerals, and found that any particle of even that great range of sizes, up to 10 times as big as the average cell, can find its way into the bloodstream. And so particulate matter really should be taken along with foods that are so coarse, including fat in the diet, but cellulose in the food is a good fiber that will prevent those particles from passing into the bloodstream.
Wow. Has Dr. Pete ever heard of using, a little bit of a teaspoon of Clorox into a gallon of water to soak of vegetables and detoxified food?
Oh yeah. Peroxide is a very safe way to wash your food.
Yeah, we used to have a salsa company, and we would use fresh cilantro, lots. And then we would make a big mixture, you know, in a sink of a little bit of Clorox and water, and let it soak in there for about 10 minutes, and it would help the cilantro stay fresher longer. You know, it was a fresh product.
Oh, Clorox?
Yeah.
Ideally, peroxide, hydrogen peroxide is the safest, but Clorox in a dilute solution does disinfect.
Same nicely. Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you could use the food grade hydrogen peroxide, same way.
That leaves no chemical residue at
all. Right. What does that do to Dr. Pete? Does it pull toxins out of the vegetables and stuff like that?
Not to a significant amount. The peroxide will degrade organic toxins on the surface, but if it entered the cell, it would probably damage the nutritional quality.
Mm-hmm.
Vitamins and such are very susceptible to oxidation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Oh, somebody from Poland just saying how much they enjoy having you on, and here's somebody that's trying to navigate her way. She thread through keto and grain-free, carb-free, and the only way, she said, is it just the best way to use trial and success to try to figure out what kind of food is working for me?
It's good to know something of the chemistry of the food, but since everyone has a different, almost infinitely complex internal ecology of bacteria, everyone is going to react somewhat differently. If you're low in thyroid, for example, your digestion is going to be slow, and that will give bacteria a chance to live farther up in the intestine than they should. And there are some, besides making sure that your thyroid is adequate, using fibrous foods that are resistant to bacterial degradation helps to suppress and control the overgrowth of bacteria. I remember in the 50s, there were several cases around the world, three or four cases at a time, of people who were fermenting food. They would eat rice or bread and get drunk. They were chronically intoxicated, and when they were studied, it was found that they just had yeast growing in their stomach. When a large number of people are investigated, it turns out that the very healthiest people keep the bacteria confined to the colon, the large intestine, and a slightly stressed or sicker older person is more likely to have some in the lower ileum, where the sicker a person is, the farther up the intestine the bacteria invade until bacteria and yeast can live in the stomach and even the mouth. If you use the slightly antiseptic resistant foods, raw carrots are an example. The carrot to live in the earth has to resist lots of organisms, can't mold very easily or rot with bacteria, so it has antiseptics in it. And so when you eat a carrot, you're disinfecting your bowel fairly efficiently. Several other foods, the bran of wheat, for example, is very resistant, although the starch will support bacterial growth. Good cellulose fiber, such as in the wheat bran or in carrot itself, helps to sort of sweep out the intestine while slightly disinfecting it.
Do you still do your little carrot salad thing? What's the recipe for that, if I remember?
The carrot itself, if it's shredded and given a dressing with a little bit of olive oil or coconut oil and vinegar,
mm-hmm.
and salting it to taste, the carrot being indigestible carries the oil and vinegar, which are both fungicidal and bactericidal, through the intestine. So the oil, vinegar, and carrot combine to make a very broad spectrum antiseptic for the intestine.
Oh, that's cool. You know, with all this talk about not too much, not enough stomach acid or too much, does the hydrochloric acid in the stomach, is it actually working on digestion, or is it mostly just keeping things bacteria from overgrowing in the stomach?
Both of those.
Both?
But when some experimenters put the proper amount of stomach acid and enzymes together in a bottle, nothing much happened. But when they passed that into a piece of intestine, they put the intestine in formaldehyde to fix it, so it was definitely not living material, but it was the anatomy, the fuzzy lining of the intestine combined with the enzymes and acid of the stomach. Then the digestion went ahead. So it isn't just the enzyme and acid, but it requires the exact anatomy of the digestive system before the enzymes fully work.
So, and that exact anatomy is what? How do we figure? Would we figure that out to a supplement?
The lining of the intestine has little projections, and on those projections there are micro projections, and the digestive enzymes lie down on the surface of the cells, and the digestion happens right at the surface, so that the protein isn't digested out in the bulk phase, but right at the surface where it's contacting the intestine.
And can folks work with that with just taking extra hydrochloric acid, or do they need to do something with that?
Drugstores used to sell dilute hydrochloric acid and a glass straw so that you could drink it somewhat bypassing your teeth, which it would destroy. The people who are deficient in hydrochloric acid are simply malnourished and low thyroid. You need production of carbon dioxide, which requires thyroid. The carbon dioxide is the source of the acidification for making hydrochloric acid. And without adequate oxygen metabolism governed by thyroid, you don't make stomach acid. And with the thyroid working properly, then you can make the acid.
So a lot of this reflux stuff could all be tied back to the thyroid.
And the reflux is a matter of a combination of irritation, mostly from bacteria and undigested food, lower in the intestine, combined with the low energy of hypothyroidism, so that when your blood sugar decreases at bedtime, the irritation, instead of causing a normal head to rear top to bottom peristalsis, the irritation in the intestine sends waves of peristalsis backward up the intestine through the stomach into the esophagus.
Oh.
Walter Alvarez, a famous enterologist in the 1920s, had his medical students put some club moss spores, which are very visible under the microscope, had them put them in their rectums, and about, I think it was 10 or 15% of his students found those spores in their mouth in the morning, showing that they had had reverse peristalsis during the night.
Wow. So if that was happening for some folks, which I suspect is at night, what are some things they can do to turn that around so it doesn't back up?
Everything that keeps your blood sugar from falling too low at night, and thyroid and the other hormones are essential, but good nutrition, nothing that lowers your blood sugar too extremely, like a heavy protein meal at bedtime, will drive up the insulin and lower the blood sugar so that you get these intense symptoms at night. A more carbohydrate late in the day helps to prevent that extreme dip in blood sugar.
Certainly been a lot of said right smack some about the fish oils by Dr. Pete, and of course, he said there's still lots and lots and lots of doctors that are prescribing these fish oils, and they claim that they've been very helpful for their patients to reduce inflammation, joint pain, cardiac inflammation, and things like that. How can Dr. Pete explain how some people have a good experience with this?
For about 6 months, you do get very good anti-inflammatory effect. Some researchers found that by the time fish oil reaches your bloodstream, it is already oxidized, and these free radical oxidizing fragments attack the blood cells and have an anti-inflammatory but also immunosuppressive effect for about the first six months after you use it. And then if you keep doing it, the anti-inflammatory pro-oxidative effect tends to dominate. And if you look at the brain composition of a newborn baby, they're starting to say that babies are all born deficient in essential fatty acids, but that's a normal protection of the developing brain. It makes its own unsaturated fats out of the sugar that gets through the placenta. But on a normal average diet, the brain gradually starts accumulating around puberty when growth is leveling off at the adult size. As soon as the body stops enlarging and diluting that PUFA in our diet, it starts showing a rapid accumulation in the brain. The percentage of PUFA in the brain increases steadily starting at the age of 20, and is very high in old age. So they talk about the brain needing fish oil because you find fish oil in the brain, the highly oxidized polyunsaturated fatty acids are concentrated in the brain. But that's increasing as the brain slows down in beyond middle age, where a young brain that learns very well has very little PUFA accumulated.
Yeah, very interesting. I've had lots of dental issues, writes an emailer, my whole life, and I love orange juice and would like to follow some of Dr. Pete's advice on drinking it. However, I'm concerned about that my teeth just don't like it. Most agree that amount of fructose in orange juice is equivalent to that of a sugary soda drink. Is there a way around this?
Fructose really is in some ways better than glucose as our energy supply, but because it doesn't drive the insulin secretion. Cells can take it up without insulin. And so in the experiments, they feed a basic diet, often giving 6% of PUFA in the diet plus an excess of fructose. And that's perfectly designed to make the PUFA more active, and then they blame it on the fructose. But it's a combination of more unsaturated fat than the organism can deal with when you're giving it too many calories in the easily assimilated fructose form. But ordinarily we can make our any triply or multiply oxidized unsaturated fatty acids right out of fructose and glucose. So if we deprive ourselves as far as we can of PUFA, then our sugars will be handled properly to make the omega minus 9 series, which are anti-inflammatory, anti-degenerative fatty acids, versus the N minus 6 and N minus 3, which are unstable.
If one was eating a generous amount of fruit, because people seem to do well with it, would there be a fasting blood sugar, Dr. Pete, that one would want to look at in the morning with, you know, the pinprick to kind of keep tabs on where you'd want to be?
If your stress hormones aren't exaggerated during the night,
mm-hmm.
if your blood sugar is stable just because your thyroid is good and you didn't overeat protein at bedtime, then your stress hormones rise only slightly during the night. The longer the night, the more we are likely to use up our stored sugar. And when that sugar is used up, then cortisol and adrenaline rise in the morning. And that will give you a higher morning glucose. So if you're eating enough fruit, milk and orange juice, for example, are very stabilizing, that will keep your morning cortisol to a minimum so that your morning blood sugar isn't going to have that surge around dawn.
Is there something we can do at night to lower the cortisol for folks that have a hard time sleeping? Cortisol level gets too high.
The fibrous diet is one of the very effective things because irritation in the intestine it escapes our control when our blood sugar dips, and so you don't notice that your intestine is at all irritated during the daytime. But when the blood sugar falls, then we, in effect, are having an allergic reaction to any irritating thing in the intestine. A thing like some kind of mild fibrous food in the afternoon protects against that irritation. Aspirin late in the day or at bedtime reduces some of the amplification of the irritation. Having some carbohydrate like orange juice or milk with sugar right at bedtime helps to maintain sleep and reduce the cortisol rise during the night.
And what kind of fibrous foods would you try in the afternoon?
Carrot salad, for example.
Carrot salad.
Cooked mushrooms are another for a variety. Cooked bamboo shoots. You can make some interesting dishes with cheese and bamboo shoots.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sounds good. Let's see. I don't see any apparent link to subscribe to Dr. Pete's newsletter or to buy his books. How do we go about doing this?
The email address for that is Ray Pete's newsletter, all one word, @gmail.com.
Ray Pete's newsletter @gmail.com. And your books generally available around Amazon and places?
I tried selling them at Barnes & Noble about 20 years ago, and it was too much trouble.
Yeah, I understand. Ray Pete's newsletter, gmail.com. That's the place to go. Right. Here's an email. I read that over 100 years ago it was well known among endocrinologists that accessory thyroid glands are common, usually between the aortic arch and the hyoid bone. Wow. Sometimes within the bone itself. How effective are these accessory thyroids in the primary gland if the primary gland is removed?
Sometimes a person does fine with the remnants that are removed, but other times they go into a totally hypothyroid, athyreotic state. So you don't want to count on having more thyroids if you have one removed. Starting around the 1930s, the Cleveland Clinic, which had pioneered thyroidectomy, and they were removing more than 1,000 every year, they realized that that wasn't the right approach. And by the time George Crile Jr. Took over, they were doing almost no thyroid surgeries, maybe a dozen a year, for only advanced cancer. For most thyroid so-called cancer, they didn't have to do surgery. They would just supplement something like Armour thyroid to the point that their TSH went down to zero. You can adapt to that and live perfectly well with what had been a reason for removing the whole thyroid gland for the diagnosed cancer.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from a fellow in Wisconsin. He said, having trouble with high levels of barium and high blood pressure. Can you suggest any kind of detox ideas for this?
If someone is interested in the effect of thyroid on blood pressure, I have at least a dozen articles I could email them showing that it's very common to simply cure high blood pressure by correcting the thyroid function.
Wow. Would eating grapefruit or drinking freshly squeezed grapefruit juice have the same anti-estrogenic effects as the orange juice?
There were a few publications about 15 years ago, I think, in Northern Europe, in which they found estrogen increasing effects of grapefruit juice, but later publications found that that wasn't accurate. I think they were using the typically under-ripened grapefruit that has some irritating properties, but good ripe grapefruits are very sweet, and like orange juice, they have a protective pro-oxidative, pro-thyroid effect. And when your thyroid is working right, your estrogen is kept minimal, except during the 1 or 2 days around ovulation. It's safe for the estrogen to surge, but otherwise the thyroid should trim the estrogen down to a minimum.
Mm-hmm. Dom writes in, what's the best way to activate our own stem cells? Versus getting them injected.
Every night, the stress of darkness activates a surge of, of new stem cells. It's a natural regulation process for them to be born, but the trouble is that our stress hormones, prostaglandins and such, kill them as soon as they're born. In the pancreas, for example, the stem cells are chronically, every day, some are being produced to replace the other, the insulin-secreting cells. It has been called the streaming organism because cells in each organ are constantly being formed to replace the old working cells as they are damaged. The skin, everything should have this stream of new cells replacing cells that are damaged by sunlight, for example. So that if you don't replace them, you get an accumulation of mutated cells. The streaming new cells should remove those mutant damaged cells. But in the pancreas, for example, the PUFA and the prostaglandins, nitric oxide and other stress-induced chemicals kill those newly born pancreatic beta cells as fast as they're produced, so you stay deficient in the ability to make insulin.
Mm-hmm.
But sugar can contradict that. Sugar lets the stem cells survive. Same in the brain. It's a competition between polyunsaturated fats and glucose for whether the newly born cells will survive.
A couple more here, then we'll let you go back to work. Folks have been talking about this intermittent fasting to increase stem cells. In general, Dr. Pete, do you think the body wants to eat every so often, or does it do fine if you want to skip 18 hours or something?
Oh, sure. A healthy liver can store, and the muscles and brain, everything stores glycogen, so that a healthy person should easily be able to go 12 to 18 hours. But if your liver is not so healthy, if you've got too much PUFA in your body, as soon as your blood sugar dips, you're going to pull PUFA into circulation and start killing things.
So is there a benefit if you can go and do that intermittent fasting, do you think, for the body?
I've known people who just by correcting their thyroid and maybe using little bits of coffee to help their thyroid get going, were able to go many hours without having to eat to avoid stress.
So a little coffee actually kicks it up a little bit, your thyroid?
Yeah, aspirin and coffee by reducing the inflammatory things help the thyroid to keep oxygen going.
Kira wants to know, does decaf coffee still have some of the same benefits that regular coffee offers? I understand that the benefits of the caffeine itself are gone, so is it even worth drinking?
Yeah, if it's decaffeinated with carbon dioxide in a safe way rather than a chlorine solvent, the coffee, despite the very small amount of caffeine left in it, it still contains potassium, magnesium, niacin, some of the B vitamins. A study in England about 40 years ago found that the average English person was getting about 20% of their vitamins from either coffee or tea. So it isn't insignificant as a nutrition source.
Just want to be careful how they do the decaffeination.
For a while they were using, I think it was ethylene trichloride or something.
Oh, great.
Carcinogenic solvent.
Sounds pretty good. Here is an email that says, I was always cold at night. Now I'm really warm most of the time. I took Armour Thyroid a few years ago, but I can't find it anywhere now. Then they switched to Nature Thyroid. Now that isn't available, so I'm using No Thyroid.
The good thing about Armour used to be that they tested every batch on mice and made sure that it had the same potency from batch to batch, because the cows vary in their thyroid quality depending on what they were eating and where they came from. But in the 1990s, the company was sold, went through several changes of ownership, each time forgetting what they were doing to some extent. So I don't know exactly what the current availability of Armour Thyroid is. But there are products that say they're using pure beef or pork thyroid glands. So I think it's a matter of trying out different products and seeing, according to your response in pulse and temperature, whether they're working the way Armour used to.
Pretty curious how the shortages that we see going on.
It's powered by the regulators. The FDA has been serving the pharmaceutical industry to sell products. They've progressively taken off more of the traditional herbal products. For example, even quinine that was used for hundreds of years was given by the FDA to one company to monopolize so they could make more money on it. Several products like that have been simply awarded to the friends of the FDA to charge 100 times more than the product always sold for.
Yeah. Finally, here's one for you. Through diet, exercise, and supplementation, doctors have recommended that I've been able to lower my triglycerides between 400 mg and 500 mg. The prescribed supplements are 2,400 mg of omega-3, 6, and 9. What can I replace these supplements with?
I'm using orange juice instead of bread starch, for example, can make a big difference. Starches are very strong for stimulating triglyceride synthesis. Vegetables and orange juice and anything that supports your thyroid function is going to normalize your triglycerides.
So, good job, Doc. Thanks for spending some time with us once again. So we have Ray Pete newsletter. Is it a singular Ray Pete newsletter at Gmail?
No, with an S.
Ray Pete's.
Ray
Pete's newsletter at gmail.com for folks to get books and stuff and your newsletter and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks for being here.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really been a pleasure. It's an honor, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye. Take care.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ray P. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. He's a good one. We're gonna put on her. I can't believe Sharon actually got a little picture of me that she's got a tinfoil hat. Did you see that? Yeah, you can see it up there on the top. That's funny. We'll do a little tinfoil hat Monday. We're going to have some fun tomorrow. And I think you're going to enjoy talking with Richard Grove. That'll be tomorrow, 9 o'clock. Thanks for your ongoing support. I love you all very much, and I appreciate you being here. And especially, and I take very, very sincerely the idea that you'll try some of these different products that we recommend, because, you know, you work efficiently and effectively for your little dollars, and you want to be careful when you start trading them for stuff. And so we appreciate your ongoing support and trust in a lot of the different things that we promote, and because we think that they're some of the best, and we know the source, and so it means a lot to us that when you try them, and it keeps our whole business model working here, and we do what we do. And so I love you all very much. Thanks a lot. We'll see you tomorrow. Have some fun.
From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.